Good evening. This is the Labor Exchange. I'm Dennis Kreese, a member of the Boulder Area Labor Council, AFL-CIO. Please note, this is a replay from a previous Labor Exchange radio show from Monday, July 22, 2019. The subject at that time was From Coors to California, the Journey of a Union Activist. With us then was a special guest, David Sickler, former Coors brewery worker and former AFL-CIO representative and organizer. Dave, thank you for being on Labor Exchange at KGNU.
Oh, thank you, Dennis. It's good to be talking to my home state.
All right. Dave, let's begin with some background. Could you talk about your initial employment as a worker at the Coors Brewery, Golden, Colorado, and beyond that, what kind of work did you perform, and when did this date begin, and was shift work involved? What was the wages, benefits, working conditions at that time?
Sure. I was working, I actually was a member of Labor's Local 720, working at Pearl Mac Construction in North Glen, and they were building new houses back then in 1961-62. And winter was coming on, they were laying everybody off. And so I applied at Coors, and I was about 19 years old when I got hired, and started work then in 1963.
All right, then. And so 63, and again, like, did you work shifts or was it all, you know, day work?
Oh, yes. No, they ran 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. We were working 12-hour shifts, and it was brutal because we'd have to double back and work from noon to midnight for 2 weeks, then midnight to noon for 2 weeks. You just had to keep doing that, which was pretty difficult on the body.
Yeah.
It was hard to sleep. It was hard to do almost anything, and people got sick a lot, but they continued to work because they couldn't afford to take off.
Ironically.
So we definitely had shift work. It was 24 hours a day. We didn't have air conditioning in the summer. We didn't have heat in the winter. I worked in an area on the bottle line in the basement where they would bring the bottle stack from the bars and the restaurants. And they, you know, they dump their ashtrays. Back in those days, everybody smoked. And so they would dump ashtrays into these boxes of bottles so that when they come down and they were picked up by a machine that took the bottles out of the boxes, it would just make all of that cigarette ash into the air. So you were breathing it. You go up to the bathroom and look in the mirror and you'd have these black streaks under your nostrils where you had been breathing this cigarette ash into your lungs. And do that for 12 hours a day.
All right,
and
then.
My job was to help those bottles get into what they call the soaker machines, where they'd be washed and then go on to be filled with beer, pasteurized, and then sent back on out.
All right, then.
You know.
Let's move on here. Which union were you represented by, and were you an active member at the outset of your work?
We were represented by the Brewery Workers Local 366, which was a local union of the Brewery, Flour, Cereal, and Soft Drink Workers of America. And that local union had a strike in 1957 that was devastating. It went on strike for about 14 months, got busted. The leadership of the local had to apologize for going on strike to Bill Coors before the workers could get their jobs back. So by the time I went to work there in 1963, it was a pretty depressed place to be. The union was basically dead inside. Nobody wanted anything to do with being a shop steward or an activist or anything like that. But I didn't plan on actually staying there all that long. I had visions of buying a horse ranch and all that kind of crap.
Did you, with Local 366, did you ever, evolve or have any leadership positions with?
Oh, sure. I actually became an activist. And was on the building committee. We were building a new union building at the time. And so I got on the building committee, and then I became a shop steward because nobody wanted to be one. It was in a department of 600 people, and not one person wanted to be a shop steward. I became a shop steward, and then I became board member. Then I went on to start the union's first newsletter. I became the editor of the newspaper. And then our business manager got cancer, And I had, was organizing, actually, he was taking me off the job for a while. I was organizing over-the-road truck drivers and a plant called Jeffco Can. And he asked me to take his place because he was dying of cancer. The executive board approved it. The membership then approved it at delegate meetings. And then I became business manager in 1972.
All right, then. You know, let's go move on now to more of the content of the show. And I have this with stuff you sent me, the Coors boycott timeline, 1957 and 1987. So could you begin with the respective boycotts by the Crusade for Justice? That would be Corky Gonzalez, longtime activist, and American American GI Forum, and LULAC, because of Coors' refusal to hire Latinos. And this time frame was like 1966 to 1969. And beyond that, did this discrimination extend to blacks and women as well?
Absolutely. It extended to blacks. And African-American groups had boycotts against Coors. Women groups had boycotts against Coors. Coors refused to hire a woman in the plant other than secretarial work until 1972, when Colorado passed its state law banning discrimination against women for hiring. And then, quote, one of the personnel guys told me, we may have to hire them, but we don't have to keep them, which amounted to blatant discrimination in my book. And I flatly told him, well, if you don't try to keep them, I guarantee you, maybe I can't file a grievance against you because you'll probably fire them before they get off probation, but we'll damn sure take them downtown and have them file EEOC charges against you.
Yeah, I saw I saw in your stuff there was lawsuits, and then, and I think that, you know, I brought up the three Latino groups. I thought that was, they were early and, kind of pioneers with, going after Coors.
They were, but, you know, at the same time, they were also boycotts by students, college students, because Joe Coors was a regent at Boulder CU. And in those days, they had Students for a Democratic Society on campus, and he banned their publication from being allowed on campus at all, and was just so anti-student that there was a student boycott of the beer as well. So you had all these various groups. There were gay boycotts at the same time. There was a major gay boycott going on in San Francisco at the time. As a matter of fact, they actually closed down a distributorship in conjunction with the Teamsters, who had struck that distributorship. And the gay movement joined with the Teamsters, and they actually closed down a distributorship in San Francisco before we actually launched our boycott.
All right, then, Dave,
let's
move on what you're doing good. But, the listeners need to know this, too, is that when were you hired by the AFL-CIO as a representative and organizer? And what were your initial duties, and where were you assigned?
Yeah, they actually started talking to me about coming to work for them in 1974. I didn't go to work for them until 1976. They hired me as an organizer because I'd had organizing victories over the road drivers, organizing victories at a plant called Jeffco Can, which made cans and bottle caps for Coors. And the funny story about that is that I told the guys that came over and wanted me to organize them that I didn't want anything to do with it because this Teamsters had tried to organize it and they couldn't get it off the ground. The UAW tried to organize it and couldn't get it off the ground. Steelworkers had tried and couldn't get it off the ground. What I didn't realize is that Jeffco Can had hired a bunch of new Vietnam vets. He didn't want to be screwed with, and they were using the same attorney that Coors used. And of course, Coors controlled Jeffco Can, their employment policies, anyway. And so I figured, the workers are just going to gate rattle us and push us for a wage increase and then dump us after we got a campaign started. But then I found out these guys were serious. And so I gave them some cards to sign. And long story short, they came back in 3 days with about 95% of everybody signed up in the plant, so I knew they were serious. And long story short, we organized them, but then we ended up on a six-month strike. But we got a damn good contract for them. We ended up winning it. Anyway, the AFL-CIO put me to work May 1976, They asked me to come out to Los Angeles to study the most successful organizing committee project they had in the United States at that time, which was called the Los Angeles Orange County Organizing Committee.
Yeah, I want to get to that. I want to get to that later. You know, because I want to I want to follow this Coors timeline. You know, for a couple more questions.
Sure.
So, 1977, quote unquote, 1,000 brewery workers launch a strike against Coors to defend employee rights.
That's right.
David, what were some of the primary issues, grievances here for all these striking workers?
Well, let me just give you one example. They had 25 reasons outlined in the contract why a worker could be immediately discharged. The 26th reason, the last one, was any other reason not listed above. A little bit of salt in the wound. So that was their attitude. One of the other examples I can give you about their attitudes about us was the attorney told me to my face, "We buy our workers like we buy our barley." That was the attitude they had towards us. The issues that caused the strike was more regressive contract language. They wanted to force a shop steward to take a lie detector test to prove he was telling the truth about any grievance he wrote and submitted.
That's amazing. Dave, Dave, President George Meany, AFL-CIO, appointed you to lead a boycott, of course. So with that said, could you explain all the duties involved with this assignment and the travel throughout the West and the United States?
Well, here's the irony. There was never any class or instruction or a set of rules issued by the AFL-CIO for a boycott. What the AFL-CIO normally did was they would take a request from an affiliate for a boycott sanction, and they would just sanction whatever that union product was that they wanted boycotted. They would sanction it and spread the word. That was about it. We were a directly affiliated local union. We did not have an international union. So we had a direct linkage to the AFL-CIO. So that made it a little bit different. But there was no set of rules or assignments on the boycott. I had studied boycotts for years because I knew if we ever had to take Coors on, which I was convinced we would someday, because they would go after us like they'd gone after every union before us to totally destroy it. And what that meant was putting us on strike, keeping us on strike for a year, then taking us before the National Labor Relations Board for a decertification election in which only the scabs inside could vote. Strikers could not vote in that election.
Well, that's where I'm at now. Yeah. Could you talk about the 1978 Local Union 366 decertification in a National Labor Relations Board vote ending the brewery strike?
Once you're on strike for a year, the employer can petition the board for what's called an RD election, a decertification election. That election allows only the scabs that are inside working to vote. So you can imagine what the election would be like with workers picketing the plant every day, yelling at scabs as they cross the picket line. The scabs were not going to vote in favor of the union, which they didn't. We still had 400 people inside vote for the union, which surprised me. 400 people still voted for the union out of 1,500. But that's the cruel joke that the National Labor Relations Act plays on union workers.
All right, then
risk your job. You go out, you stay out a year, then there's an election, and you have no voice in it.
All right, I'll get right back to you, Dave. For those of you who have joined us late, the subject of tonight on the Labor Exchange is From Coors to California, the Journey of a Union Activist. And with us is a very special guest, David Sickler, former Coors Brewery worker and former AFL-CIO representative and organizer. Dave, just to finish up that part here with the after the decertification, in your capacity as a representative organizer, talk about your efforts. Did you make to deny Coors market entry in Washington, D.C., New York, New Jersey, and other East Coast locations? And with that said, what kind of support did you get from labor unions and progressive organizations in those areas?
Okay, but let me explain before I get to the Washington, D.C. and New York and New Jersey areas, because it's very important to note that Coors only marketed in 11 states when we went on strike and started the boycott. But 50% of everything they produced went to California. Coors, believe it or not, had fluctuating month to month, according to Beer Marketers Insights, a publication that monitors the brewery industry, 43 to 44% of the beer market in California, which is unheard of. Any one beer having that kind of stronghold on the market, but that's the stronghold they have. 50% of their production, they produced 13 million barrels of beer a year at that point. 50% of that went to California, mainly in two more big market shares, San Francisco area and L.A., especially East L.A. The Latino market really consumed a lot of the Coors beer. So I knew in order to have any impact on their sales with the boycott had to be first initiated to a great degree in California. So I developed 50 boycotters. Half of those I took to California. Half went to Northern California. Half went to Southern California. And we started our boycott. But after studying boycotts for a lot of years, the farm workers, Ferris Flax, R.G. Sloan, these are some of the more successful boycotts that were ran. One thing they had in common was they targeted their boycotts. They didn't shotgun them like a lot of the unions did with their boycotts. Shotgun boycotts don't work. It's ineffective. But targeting key areas where you know you're going to get support and there's heavy use of the product does work. So I targeted. I single shot the boycott. So we just put the major emphasis in San Francisco, Los Angeles, especially East L.A. And, of course, I had a lot of potential support given the earlier Latino boycotts in East L.A. Then I had made friends with labor guys that were in unions but also lived in East L.A., and they really helped me. We started sweeping the boycott out neighborhood by neighborhood. We go block by block. We picket liquor stores, picket restaurants, picket grocery stores that sold Coors beer, and slowly but surely, we wiped them out. And then I knew we were using the right tactics when Danny Villanueva, who owned the major Hispanic television station in Los Angeles, had the Coors distributorship for East L.A. He sold his distributorship because we took that many sales away from him.
What about, again,
I knew we were on the right track.
Let's go back and just comment briefly because I want to, you know, finish this up. Is that you did spend time in Washington, D.C., in New York and New Jersey,
sure,
and other East
Washington,
locations.
New York, yeah.
Yeah, and
but
you
it was towards
made
the end of the boycott. Actually, you know, before we really put an intense boycott in New York and New Jersey, which represented 12% of the market at that time, of all beer sold, just New York and New Jersey had 12% of the market. And the Coors definitely wanted that market. They didn't want it tainted. So that's when they called the AFL-CIO and wanted to sit down at the bargaining table and settle.
All right, then. The Coors boycott was settled by the AFL-CIO on August 19th, 1987. And you've told me, ironically, that's your birthday. So
that's my birthday. Best birthday present ever.
What issues led to the settlement?
Well, what led to the boycott was that Coors didn't want to hemorrhage any more market share. And so they said that. Now, here's the thing. We couldn't demand that they settle with the brewery workers because, remember, they got decertified in 1978, so they were no longer a union.
That's correct.
There was no longer a local union there to settle with. So the best the AFL-CIO could negotiate was a neutrality agreement with any international union that wanted to organize the brewery workers, and there were several. There were steelworkers, UAW, machinists, and Teamsters. Those four unions wanted to organize. Now, in the meantime, since the boycott had started, Budweiser built a plant in Fort Collins. So the Teamsters felt that they would have a good case to organize. But the Teamsters at that point, when we settled, were not affiliated with the AFL-CIO. So they did not get the nod from the AFL-CIO. The AFL-CIO arbitration division gave the okay to the machinists because they had brewery workers at Miller's and a number of other breweries around the country. So they gave the nod to the machinists. The machinists ran a campaign and lost it. Then subsequently, by August, later, they joined the AFL-CIO. So then they won the nod from the AFL-CIO to have a campaign. Again, they ran a campaign just at the brewery and lost it. Now, I could give you another whole show on why those unions lost that election at the brewery.
We'll do that. We'll do that for a whole show. So, you know, we got about 8 minutes left or 7 minutes.
Oh, okay.
And I want to get into this important aspect of your book, your publication. It's not going to do justice. I may only get to this one question, but it under immigrant worker organizing. And this began in 1977, you know, you as a rep and organizer, but could you discuss your initial assignment to study the, as you previously said, the Los Angeles Orange County's organizing committee, and then start a similar organizing committee in the Mountain States?
Yes. Well, they sent me out to study. I wanted to see what made it so successful. It was a multi-union organizing campaign committee that came together, and basically the heart and soul of it was target clearance. A union would pick a target to go after and then see if there was anybody else interested in it. If everybody else agreed that nobody else was interested in it, then they'd get that clearance, target clearance. And they could go campaign at that particular facility without worrying about anybody else intervening on that target. See, prior to that, unions were knocking each other out of the box in Los Angeles. It was internal warfare. Somebody would go out and start a campaign, then somebody else would intervene in it. And then nobody would end up getting it. And so the National AFL-CIO, one of its executive board meetings, had a long discussion about this craziness and said, look, we need to put together a committee, install some traffic signals so labor stops killing itself out there. So they did, and it became highly successful. It was really working, and we were winning a lot of campaigns because not only were people agreeing to not intervene, they were sending some of their organizers to help organize that plant, and then vice versa. The favor was returned by other unions. So we ended up doing a lot of multi-union organizing, which was very successful.
All right, Dave.
They wanted me to study that.
Let's get into this, though. Like I said, immigrant worker organizing. What was your assessment of Latino immigrant workers in a great many factories? Any organizing with these workers? And if not,
very
why?
Little. There was some. There was very little. When I started asking questions about why so little, I was told, well, they don't speak English, they're scared, they don't want to organize. Well, I didn't believe that because I'd worked with immigrant workers doing construction work at Pearlmac. And so I knew those people weren't scared, and I knew that wasn't right because they were real pro-union, the ones I was working with. So I started checking with the unions that were doing organizing, and I run across the furniture workers who had 15 organizing wins and got contracts for all 15 organizing wins, which was highly unusual. So I called the head organizer, it was a woman, and asked her to sit down with me and talk to me about why she was so successful when other people weren't. And come to find out, I mean, she had a very smart strategy. She didn't compromise the workers at work. She went to their homes, met with the entire family. She'd get 2-3 families together, then it'd expand until she had, and the employer had no idea she was doing organizing until she got about 90-95% of everybody signed up to go union. Then she'd drop it on the employer, and the employer knew he didn't have much choice because most all of his workers were already signed up to go union.
Well, the whole thing,
getting contract after contract.
Well, the whole thing here is then that you eventually, you know, had a different vision and objectives. The contrast with several unions, and he just eventually told the true story. And ironically, I'm a life member. I worked in the field in Laborers Local 720. I'm 41 years, and you're right. You know,
we're brothers.
Yeah, we are brothers. And the one thing is that you're right. All the Latinos I worked with right from the beginning were very pro-union. Dave, we have about 3 minutes left, and you touched on the furniture workers, and we beyond that, you know, there's Labor's Immigration Assistance Project and the California My Immigrant Workers Association that you worked with.
And one thing I was very impressed with is your work is that, you know, it was American Racing Equipment Company, 2,000 immigrant workers from Guatemala, yeah. Mexico, El Salvador, and Ecuador. That had to be a huge victory.
It was a huge victory, but it was shadowed by the drywall workers' strike that we had, which was 4,000 workers. And we ended up organizing that industry in Los Angeles, Orange County, Fresno, and most of San Diego. We ended up with 60% of the industry being organized following that drywall strike. And American Racing, you're right, was a major victory.
No, when I saw that and I read that, I'm going, man, you demand. You know, that's a big thing. Dave, let's take, you know, we got 2 minutes, but take 1 minute and then I'll give you 1 minute to summarize here. But, you know, talk about the political issues in the context of immigrant worker organizing. I'm just picking this one. 1986 Immigrant Reform and Control Act, signed yeah. by President Ronald Reagan.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And so I knew right away this was something we had to be involved in for many reasons. One, first reason was to protect our existing members who belong to our affiliates that were eligible for amnesty and U.S. citizenship. And so we knew there were a bunch of sleazy operators putting up shingles to supposedly assist these immigrants and these workers to qualify for U.S. Citizenship that were going to fleece them for thousands of dollars. And so the INS was overwhelmed with trying to naturalize 4 million immigrant workers eligible for citizenship. And so they were allowing organizations to get signed up and be approved by them to process people. So I asked the AFL-CIO for permission to be one of those organizations, and they agreed. And so we put it together. It was called Labor's Immigrant Assistance Project. And we processed over 20,000 people, and we developed out of that the California Immigrant Workers Association, which was the organizing arm of it. And that's what led to the organizing of American Racing and the drywall strike. And that went on then to produce people who became naturalized and could vote. And we took back assembly and Senate seats that had been Republican for 75 years.
All right, then, Dave, we have to finish up. And it's okay. Only about 45 seconds. So as a summary, do you have any final thoughts for this KGNU listening audience? And how can one purchase this book publication, From Coors to California, Dave Sickler and the New Working Class?
Sure. The book can be purchased at the UCLA Labor Center website book section. Just Google UCLA Labor Center. When you get on their website, just go to the book section, and it's right there. My final thought is to encourage everybody not to go to war against immigrant workers. They're going to rebuild our labor movement just like immigrants built our labor movement from the beginning. Our labor movement was built by the Irish and the Jewish and the Italian and all the other different immigrant groups that came over here. They're the ones that gave us strength to start with. These new immigrant workers are revitalizing our labor movement wherever we organize them.
And I agree with you 100%, I'm sure the vast majority of this listening audience would agree with you as well. So, Dave, thank you again for being on Labor Exchange at KGNU. And for those of you who joined us even later, the show tonight was From Coors to California, The Journey of a Union Activist. And with us was Dave Sickler, former Coors brewery worker and former AFL-CIO representative organizer.
If you have any comments about this show or any other show on KGNU, please call 303-447-9911. And next week, Monday, December 16th, please listen to La Lucha Sigue at 6 p.m. This has been a Labor Exchange, and I am Dennis Kreese for KGNU Community Radio.